Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. In Tennessee, Willow Osborne is a 14-year-old musician in Pigeon Forge.
You know, whenever I had to go in for, like, teacups and stuff, you know, they're like, you play bluegrass? That's kind of weird. And then I said, you know what? Who cares? You just gotta do what you love. And if they don't think it's cool, I think it's cool.
In Kentucky, we hear about programs that are helping people like Josh May grow small businesses.
So far, it's been really helpful in learning how to translate what your ideas are and make a formal business plan so that you can approach banks and loan agents and that kind of thing.
And we'll go to Pennsylvania to meet a hummingbird who's sticking around till Thanksgiving, despite the cold November chills. You'll find these stories and more this week Inside Appalachia. Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. Last week, we heard two reports from a joint investigation on the mining industry by NPR and Mine Safety and Health News. The investigation found that mining companies and contractors owe nearly $70 million to the government for violating federal health and safety laws. But the mine's owners have been able to stay in business and continue to extract coal. Where's the mine with the highest delinquent fines in the U.S.? For that, reporter Anna Boyko-Wyrock takes us to Kentucky.
Donnie Smith used to work underground.
We was approximately a mile and a half deep in the mountain.
At a small coal mine in Harlan County, Kentucky, simply called DNC.
If your light goes out, you can't see your hand in front of your face. You're just stuck.
His sister, his brother-in-law, and his dad worked with him.
In the evenings when I come out of the mines, me and my dad will pass each other and we stop and talk.
But on June 9th, 2009, they didn't pass each other as usual.
When I got outside, my dad was sitting on the buggy and he just looked at me, you know, and I felt like he wanted to say something that day and I felt like I should have said something, but he just kind of sat there and looked at me and then he smiled and pulled out, you know, never said nothing. And I remember that it bothered me so bad that I turned around and I watched him actually, you know, leave and go under the mountain on the buggy.
Smith was still thinking about it when he got home.
We actually heard the ambulance going up the road. And my brother-in-law, Chad, worked second shift with my dad. He stopped by the house. And when Chad pulled in, the way he got out and the way he looked, I knew something was wrong.
Smith's dad had died in the mine. His name was Rome Mead. He had been underground when a supply car broke loose and crushed him.
Today is July the 10th, 2009. This is the interview session of the fatal accident investigation.
State investigators talked with the miners who worked at the DNC mine. They recorded the interviews. Anthony Goins was underground during the accident. He ran over to help Mead.
Was he conscious at that time?
His eyes would kind of move, but I hollered his name 100 times. Seemed like.
Okay.
And one time I got like a gurgle out of him, but never got a word whatsoever out of him.
Okay.
Today, that single mine, the DNC mine, owes the government more money than any other mine or mining company in the United States. Over $4 million. That's according to mine delinquency records provided by the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration, or MSHA. The $4 million is all for unpaid fines. Penalties for violating health and safety laws. MSHA says it doesn't have the authority to close a mine for racking up unpaid penalties, and it hasn't made collecting the fines a priority. Federal records show that DNC hasn't paid most of its fines since 2006. NPR analyzed a massive federal database of accidents and safety violations in mines across the country and compared them to the delinquency records. We examined hundreds of pages of state and federal mine safety records and reports. And we found that as DNC's overdue fines grew, the mine continued to violate safety laws 1,500 times in 8 years. According to citations written by federal inspectors, a third of those violations could have seriously hurt or killed miners. The most common hazards were ones that could lead to fires or explosions. Equipment was badly maintained, sometimes jury-rigged with tape.
There was rocks falling down from the top.
Marie Mead is Rome Mead's daughter. She also worked at the mine.
You was always looking above your head to make sure that nothing was going to fall on you while you were doing your job.
Inspectors wrote that up, too. They noted that the falling rocks could be as large as 30 feet long and 10 feet thick. They fell because the mine roof wasn't supported properly. Another violation. To top it off, managers were fudging paperwork, according to violations reviewed by NPR, and miners didn't have proper rescue gear. If there was an immediate threat to safety or health, inspectors removed miners from the site. In the past 8 years, they did that 145 times. But that was only temporary. The miners soon returned, and the hazards came back too. And while it amassed over $4 million in delinquent fines, Labor Department data show that the DNC mine produced close to 800,000 tons of coal. That coal, based on average annual prices reported by the Energy Department, was worth about $50 million.
State your full name, please.
Jeffrey Lee Bruce.
June 6th, 2009, DNC miner Jeff Bruce had been towing a trailer around a corner underground when it broke loose and killed Roe Mead. The car was laden with concrete blocks. It weighed close to 5 tons. The thin, rusty chain Bruce had used to tow it was too weak.
They start getting weak, I change them out.
But Bruce told investigators that was the chain they usually used.
Is this common practice?
I've done it a lot.
And he said mine management never told him he should have only used the thick tow bar designed for the job.
No.
State investigators determined Bruce should have used the proper equipment to tow such a heavy load. They cited him and mine management for that failure. But we wanted to know why. No matter how many times inspectors wrote citations, the fines weren't deterring the mine from violating health and safety laws, and why the fines weren't being paid. So NPR went to the DNC mine site in Harlan County, Kentucky. We wanted to speak to Barry Rogers, the DNC mine superintendent listed on the citations.
Them fines are not mine. I don't own no part of DNC. I'm just not going to talk to nobody about it.
Okay, well, yeah. I'd be curious for an explanation of why all the violations and why all the fines happened in the first place. Do you have an explanation for that?
Nope. I just got no comment on none of it. I'm not even going to talk about it.
Rogers walked away. The owner of DNC Mining Corporation is Horace Garrison Hill. He goes by Gus. In a deposition last year, he said he's the sole owner and officer of the company. The DNC mine is not currently active, but Hill still owns other coal businesses. For weeks, we called his companies to talk with him, but never heard back. So we went to Southwest Virginia to find him.
Hi there, I'm looking for Mr. Gus Hill, please. That's you?
Hi, Mr. He was sitting in the driver's seat of a red Lincoln pickup in the back of one of his businesses. Hill is in his late 60s, with straight black hair swept to the side and dark glasses. He said the mine managers control everything at DNC.
They control everything. They do everything.
Mm-hmm. But you're the one who owns
it. I get the blame when they do it.
Hill said he gets the blame for what the mine managers do. Andy declined to answer any other questions. Now, Hill's DNC mine owes its millions of dollars of fines to the Mine Safety and Health Administration, but it's hardly made a dent in the debt. So we went to the agency's headquarters. We asked the head of the agency, Joe Main, why the government hasn't collected the unpaid fines.
Where we have put our efforts, it wasn't at the fine at the end of the day.
Instead, Main says regulators focused on whether the mine was operating safely while it was still open. Inspectors blitzed the mine 10 times with ramped-up surprise visits, more than any other mine.
There's evidence abound to show that we aggressively had DNC under our microscope and was implementing the strategies that was aimed at protecting those miners.
But it wasn't until 2012 that the government took aggressive action to force the mine to pay. It went to federal court and sued for unpaid penalties. By then, Gus Hill had closed the DNC mine, according to federal records. This was 3 years after Roe Mead lost his life, and 6 years after the fines first became overdue. In the meantime, three other miners were injured at the mine. Last year, the government got a $2 million judgment from the court. That's half the mine's unpaid fines. The company has made a series of small payments since then, but not enough to keep up with interest and penalties, so the debt continues to grow. For NPR News, I'm Anna Boyko-Wyrock.
When I was a curly-headed baby,
My daddy sat me down upon his knee. He said, son, you go to school and learn your letters. Don't be no dusty miner like me. For I was born and raised at the mouth of a hazard holler. Coal cars roaring and a rumbling past my door. Now they stand in a rusty row all empty. And the yelling and stop here anymore. Well, I used to think my daddy was a black man. Scrape enough to buy the company store. But now he goes to town with empty pockets, and his face is white as a February snow. For I was born and raised at the mouth of the hazard holler. Coal cars roaring and a rumbling past my door. Now they stand in a rusty row all empty, and the yelling and don't stop here anymore. Well, last night I dreamed I went down to the office to get my pay like I'd done before. Them cutsy vines had covered up the doorway, and the trees and grass were grown right through the floor. For I was born and raised at the mouth of the hazard holler. Coal cars roaring and rumbling past my door.
This is Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We told you last week about a historic event in mine safety. Don Blankenship, former CEO of what was once one of the largest coal producers in the country, Massey Energy, was arraigned in federal court this week. Blankenship pleaded not guilty and is out on a $5 million cash bond. The federal judge issued a broad gag order that effectively silences all parties involved, including the families, from speaking to the media. The trial is scheduled for January 26th in front of U.S. District Court Judge Irene Berger in Beckley, West Virginia. Never before has such a high level of management faced charges like this, with the possibility of 31 years in prison. When we come back, we'll get back into the last part of this special five-part series about mine safety.
Death came looking for 29 men and took away the spirits like a feather in the wind.
In my cold West Virginia,
didn't give a warning, didn't give a sign, didn't see it coming. Down from behind by that methane devil way down in the mine.
In my core, West Virginia.
In that mighty blast, the rock, the earth then shook. The willow bell came rolling up from underground like a hurricane from hell. And the angels up in heaven mourned the 29 that fell.
Oh, West Virginia.
Watch my baby girl and be close by her side. I'll be watching her from heaven if I don't make it back outside.
In my cold West Virginia.
Virginia. Down in Montclair, West Virginia.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia, with career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
To a big bureaucratic failure with real implications for people who work in mines. Turns out, the Federal Mine Safety Agency has not collected millions of dollars in penalties for safety violations in the nation's mines. NPR's investigative series found that during the time period when mining companies were delinquent in their payments, they committed 130,000 additional violations. NPR's Howard Berkus examines one last question. Since fines are supposed to deter unsafe practices, what can be done to make delinquent mine owners pay up?
It seems simple. Fail to pay traffic tickets and you could lose your license. Fail to pay taxes and you could go to jail. But fail to pay fines for putting mine workers at risk? Well, 2,700 mine owners have gotten away with that, most for years, some for decades. They owe nearly $70 million.
You have these this class of mining companies that have failed to pay their debt, and they've continued to have violations that represent hazards to workers.
Celeste Monforton is a former federal mine safety official now at George Washington University. Most mines pay their fines, but those that don't are more dangerous than the rest. According to NPR's analysis of federal mine delinquency records and Labor Department data on mine violations and injuries, delinquent fines have injury rates that are 50% higher, and they reported nearly 4,000 injuries while they were delinquent.
There has to be a way to address this problem once and for all and as quickly as possible. Are there models in other agencies that at some point they use their authority to say, until you pay the penalty, we're going to not approve any of your mining plans?
Something like that happens in West Virginia and Kentucky when mining companies fail to pay state penalties for safety or environmental violations. They can lose their state mining permits or licenses. The same thing can happen with violations of federal environmental laws at surface mines. But the Federal Mine Safety Agency has no legal authority to shut down a mine because it hasn't paid its safety fines, which angers Congressman George Miller of California, the ranking Democrat on the House Labor Committee.
An owner of a mine can put several hundred or a thousand mine workers into an unsafe position, have them injured, be assessed a fine, and then tomorrow continue work as if nothing happened. And that's what the law is in effect doing today.
A bill pending in both the House and Senate would automatically shut down mines 6 months after fines become delinquent. But the bill has no traction, says Congressman Miller.
Some people see this as a continuation on the war on coal, that somehow if you insisted that people be safe in the workplace, that that would end the coal industry. And now when they're under pressure from natural gas and diminishing use of coal, there's no appetite to change this law. And I'm not even sure a tragic new accident would change the Congress's attitude on this.
Nothing else has worked to force payment of fines, even as mine owners commit more violations and more miners are injured. A few dozen delinquents have been hauled into federal court, but even that gets few results. NPR found that the government collected just 13% of the fines, covered by federal court orders and settlement agreements. Those can be difficult to enforce because the structure of some mining companies makes ownership and assets difficult to identify. Today, Mine Safety Chief Joe Main says he doesn't ignore delinquent fines, but instead targets dangerous mines with other tough and new enforcement.
We've overhauled our whole mine enforcement program. So mines that's operating today faces a whole different set of enforcement challenges and tools if they decide they're not going to comply with the Mine Act. We do not wait for them to rack up fines before we do something these days like we did in the past.
That includes hundreds of extra surprise mine inspections. Mines with persistent patterns of serious violations get even more scrutiny and tougher sanctions. That's effective, says Tom Lusk, the top executive at Southern Coal.
A mine can't survive on that. In today's world, an operator that's not going to comply with mine health and safety standards because of enforcement efforts is not going to be in business. They don't hesitate to shut an operator down.
Actually, they can only shut down mines temporarily. Once violations are fixed, mines reopen. Some may shut down for good eventually, but they can do a lot of damage in the meantime. In 2006, Roy Middleton and four others died in a coal mine disaster in Kentucky. The mine owners haven't paid $500,000 in penalties, according to federal delinquency records, which frustrates Middleton's daughter, Danielle.
I feel like the accident itself could have been prevented if some of these fines had been paid before. At a young age, you learn there are consequences to cheating, and it doesn't seem that way in this case.
In this case, one of the delinquent mine owners controlled eight other mines. Federal records show those mines had 1,300 more violations, 20 more injuries, and $2.4 million in additional delinquent penalties before those mines were closed or sold. Howard Berkus, NPR News.
For I was born and raised at the mouth of the hazard holler. Coal cars roaring and rumbling past my door. Now they stand in a rusty row all empty. And the yelling and don't stop here anymore. I never thought I'd learn to love a coal dust. I never thought I'd pray to hear the triple roar.
So this week, we'll get some help with the What's in a Name segment from Shane Simmons. See if you can guess it first. This town in Appalachia gets its name from a frightening creek that almost swept two travelers underwater. Is it Hell for Certain, Kentucky, Difficult, Tennessee, or Deadly, Pennsylvania? We'll have the answer after the break. This is Inside Appalachia. On Inside Appalachia, we've started a segment called What's in a Name, where we explore the history and folklore behind Appalachian places. We found two guys that are actually dedicating a whole chapter in their new book about Appalachian town names. It'll go along with an ongoing documentary project for which they've traveled thousands of miles and have interviewed dozens of people. Roxy Todd of West Virginia Public Radio checked in with Shane Simmons from member station WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, for the answer to this week's What's in a Name.
You know, whether you believe the story's legit or not is kind of up to, you know, to each person, but some of the stories are, like I said, just as good as the names themselves. I'll start with one of my favorites, and this one really kicked it all off for me. I saw this name, I was like, what in the... It's a little place called Hell for Certain, Kentucky. It's in Leslie County over there, and it's one of my favorites. I heard numerous different stories about where that name come from, but they all had the kind of the same core theme. According to the most common story, it was two travelers were having a lot of trouble trying to cross a local creek, and one of the travelers turned to the other one and said, "This is hell," and the other one replied, "For certain."
So that's the story about Hell for Certain, Kentucky. Do you know a town with an unusual name that you'd like us to explore? Send us a tweet at In Appalachia. Now, Shane Simmons began researching Appalachian towns as he began working on an oral history project earlier this year. In February, he and his friend Jason Barton began the Appalachian Project almost on a whim when they decided to take a camcorder as they drove across the southern Appalachian Mountains on a road trip. We heard from Shane earlier this summer as he and Jason were just getting started. Recently, Shane talked to Roxy Todd about how he and Jason have each put a few thousand miles on their cars.
Shane Simmons, great to have you back on Inside Appalachia. I think last time you were on the show, you said one of the main reasons you were inspired to do this project was because a lot of times people in the media come down and they interview people in Appalachia, but they just rush off. They don't give people the time to tell their story. I think your approach is very different. For one, you're not professional journalists, and I think you're listening to people with an open mind.
Yeah, exactly. Jason and I are just curious people by nature, but God knows we are amateurs when it comes to this kind of things, but the truth of the matter is, I think when we sit down with the folks that we do interview, they see where our heart's at, and they know that we're not there to try to get a story or anything else. We're trying to learn about their lives, and actually we're growing ourselves from the process. That's kind of why when I say we're trying to enjoy the ride, that's part of it too. I've learned personally so much and know so much more about the area and really become more aware of my own self from this experience. It's been an amazing thing, and I hate to see it end, to be honest with you, which hopefully it won't. We're hoping it'll continue, but you know, we've really enjoyed what we've gotten accomplished so far. We were asked a couple of months ago by a publisher to do a companion book of our interviews, and that's really been helpful because, you know, you hear somebody have this spectacular life events they've lived through, so we're able to put that on paper, and that's another part of the reason of taking our time and just getting to write that down and reliving those moments of talking to those folks and, you know, just really thinking about their story. It really becomes a part of you at that point.
You mentioned earlier that you've learned things about yourself from this project. What do you mean?
Really, and I hear this almost all the time. You know, you ask these folks, you know, what's the biggest life lesson you've learned and, you know, what changes have you seen? But really what they all come down to and what they appreciate the most are the simple things in life. That's what they really look back on their lives and appreciate. It's not, you know, a big trip or some great fun time. It's just the little things, the time they spend with family and friends and that type of thing. And that really opened my eyes up a lot to think, you know, that's one of those things I've taken for granted just like everybody else does. And I think when they're sitting there talking about their most happy memories and precious moments, it is always revolves around friends and family and the time they spend together. And a lot of them, you know, I even ask a lady, you know, I always expect, what's the biggest change you've seen in your lifetime? I always expect them to say some kind of technological advancement or that type of thing. But this lady just said, well, people just don't spend time together. That's the biggest change. People don't come over from church like they used to. And friends don't just come to visit and hang out and have dinner with you like they used to. And, you know, and I thought, wow, that's, you know, of all the things she's seen, that was the one that really jumped out as the most important change she'd seen in her life. It wasn't cell phone or, you know, anything major development in my mind. It was just something really simple.
Most of the people that you guys have interviewed are over 80, but recently you interviewed 14-year-old Willow Osborne. She's a professional musician in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. Here's a clip from that interview that you did.
I started playing banjo when I was 4 years old. When I was 3 and a half, my mom took me to see a show here in Pigeon Forge called Dixie Stampede. And I saw a banjo player there named Gary Biscuit Davis. He's a 4-time international banjo champion, and he toured with Dolly. And I saw him play the banjo in the pre-show, and I looked up at my mom and I told her that that's what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. I started professionally entertaining at about 8. I worked at Dollywood in 3 of their shows. Like any profession, yeah, I mean, you know, the same thing every day. It definitely can get, you know, said like a job. And at that point, you know, you just gotta take a few days off or do something else that you love, you know? Like, I love studying forensic science. Like, if something happened and I couldn't be a musician with my hands or something, I would totally go into forensic science. So I might, you know, work on that, and then whenever I get back to music, it's like a whole new world. Today, you said you needed space. Said you needed time. Said you had a lot of things on your mind. I live in a camper. I mean, it's not the normal kind of thing. I just want to be, you know, happy and making music. And,
you know, whenever I had to go in for like TCAPs and stuff, you know, they're like, you play bluegrass? That's kind of weird. And then I said, you know what? Who cares? You just gotta do what you love. And if they don't think it's cool, I think it's cool.
That was Willow Osborne. She just turned 14 years old, and she was being interviewed by Shane Simmons with the Appalachian Project. Shane, it's been really fun talking to you. Thank you so much.
and greatly appreciate you guys reaching out and letting us speak on the radio show. It's it was a huge help last time, and I expect it to do the same for us this time. So greatly appreciate it. Thanks. Bye.
And you can see a video from that interview with Willow Osborne on our website, wvpublic.org. Appalachians have long endured the boom and bust of the coal industry. Markets up and jobs are plentiful. Market value falls and miners are sent home. Of course, mechanization cut the need for workers, too. I was in kindergarten when Dad lost his job as a coal miner. Our house was still filled with love, so I didn't notice. But just about every generation of coal miners has some memory of coal layoffs. This time, the sharp decline is different, folks say. As poverty rates continue to soar and jobs continue to decline, there's a push to diversify the coal-dependent economy by attracting new industries to help employ people. Others argue that EPA regulations and other market factors are affecting the coal economy, but that coal jobs will come back to Appalachians. But what about small businesses, entrepreneurs? There is funding and assistance available for people who want to grow their own small business, but do enough people know where to find the help when they need it? And how many people want the help that's out there? This next story is from an ongoing series produced by WMMT Radio called Making Connections News, which covers examples of the possibilities and challenges we face in rebuilding the Appalachian economy. In this report, producer Sylvia Ryerson tells about some of the resources available for people who want to start a small business in Kentucky.
Small businesses have long played a key role in mountain communities, and leaders today see small businesses as poised to play a big part in renewing the region's economy. The U.S. Small Business Administration defines a small business as one with less than 50 employees. And according to Paul Wright, Enterprise Development Director with the Mountain Association for Community Economic Development, or MACED, when you look at the small business landscape,
in Kentucky, 94% employ less than 50, and of those, 74% employ less than 10. I think if you were to create even one job by creation of a small business, it can have a multiplier effect in the community, primarily if that business is locally owned. And so the reason why is because that person, when they're able to sell their product or service, they're able to spend money locally in the grocery store, the gas stations. They're able to hire services that are local, and that money can circulate more times in that local community, as opposed to outside ownership that may employ a few more people, but the monies go to someone that does not live locally, does not spend locally.
The good news is there's a lot of support out there for people interested in starting or growing their business.
There are 6 small business development centers in East Kentucky. There are also the Kentucky Innovation Networks. There's 6 of those as well now in East Kentucky. There's SCORE, and then there's the community development financial institutions, folks like MACED and SCED and Kentucky Highlands, who all offer business advisory services directly to entrepreneurs. But most entrepreneurs are not aware of the services that are available to them. And they are always asking, where's the one-stop directory or website that I can go to? And I'm proud to tell you there's a new resource being launched called kybizinfo.com. So they can just go onto that site and put in their zip code and put in a little bit of information about what they're looking for, and it will populate and show them what is the closest free advisory services available to them.
SCED stands for Southeast Kentucky Economic Development, and SCED is currently hosting an Entrepreneurial Smarts Small Business Training course at the Letcher County Extension Office. The course is designed to give people the resources and information they need to make their business a success. Josh May is a young business owner who co-owns the Roundabout Music Company in downtown Whitesburg, which sells new and used vinyl records, instruments, and equipment. The company is only 4 months old, and so when May heard about the SCED course happening this fall, he signed up.
When we opened the music store, we saw that there was a market there for this business, and so we already had our market and our customers somewhat identified and had made some rough plans for what our business would be. But then when it came to translating that to pen and paper and a business plan, some of that can be really tricky. Even if you know what you're doing, you don't always know how to write about it. And so I heard about this entrepreneurial training on WMMT and decided to sign up. And really, so far, it's been really helpful in learning how to translate what your ideas are and make a formal business plan so that you can approach banks and loan agents and that kind of thing.
According to Paul Wright, 80% of businesses fail within the first 5 years. But SCED believes the success rate here could be much higher if people had more tools and a good business plan right from the start. In fact, as May learned in the course, seeking assistance is proven to drastically improve this.
One of the stats that really jumped out was that something like only 20% of new small business owners reach out for training within the first 2 years of opening a business. And of those that do, 80% of those folks have been successful in keeping their business open after the first 2 years. One thing that's been really helpful about the SCED training also is they connect you with other resources throughout the region. So they've given us information on MESED's lending programs. They had Justin Prater came from the Kentucky Innovation Network and talked about their entrepreneurial challenge that's coming up and networking with other folks that are starting or running small businesses in the area. That's been hugely helpful too.
Connecting all the support systems and opportunities available is what almost everyone agrees will be key. As Justin Prater of the Kentucky Innovation Center came and told the SCED class, there is currently a startup challenge being hosted by the University of Pikeville with $5,000 in cash prizes to be given out this December. The way it works is this. Submit your business plan to startup at upike.edu by November 29th. If you're accepted as a finalist, you'll be invited to compete for the cash prizes during the second annual business plan competition on December 6th. All Kentuckians east of I-75 are eligible to apply. And as Prater told us, it can all still be in the early stages.
And with this startup challenge, it's more of a conceptual level. So if you just have an idea for a business, you know, a great idea, you know, you don't have to be in business yet, although that is preferred, you can submit to us a short, very condensed 5-page business plan, and we can actually assist you with writing those business plans and developing a presentation to get you ready. Just because you apply, you know, you may or may not get in. It just depends on how well your plan's written and if you meet our criteria. But, the earlier we can work with you, the better chance that you can get in to participate.
The winners from last year's competition showcased ideas of all kinds.
First place was a company called Veggie Magic, who developed a spray to make, say, vegetables taste better. I mean, if that, again, like I said, use your imagination. And then we had another guy who was distilling moonshine. The third place was actually some college students who had been working with a local entrepreneur and inventor on a pool heating system. So, that's just a wide variety of different things. But we also had some people competing with apps and other ideas. With this one, you don't have to be that far. If it's a strong enough concept and you have, you know, the data to back up your idea, then, you know, you can enter this one. So we're trying to expand our horizons a little bit and open it up a little bit more to the public.
From this startup challenge hosted by UPike to SCED's small business training courses and MESED's lending program, there is so much out there that small business owners can take advantage of. And while all this support will go a long way, according to Jason Bailey, director of the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy, there also needs to be a shift in how we think about economic development.
The approach to economic development and the resources for economic development are really focused on landing the big fish, on trying to lure companies into Kentucky that would potentially employ a lot of people. And that's gotten harder and harder for the state. There are fewer and fewer of those big fish out there. And it's always been difficult for Eastern Kentucky. There was a period in the 1990s where the region built a lot of industrial parks with coal severance money. And the result of that in terms of being able to lure larger companies in was not very successful. Potentially, if we put more money or more resources and effort into helping all the little fish do a little bit better, you may not have as many high-profile ribbon cuttings for politicians, but you potentially could have a more diverse, stronger economy over the long term if you took that approach. So there is some movement in that direction, I think. But by and large, the overriding assumption about how you do economic development is still about big tax breaks for big companies.
A part of supporting an alternative approach, which Bailey argues would lead to broader local ownership and greater local control of resources, is public support for private enterprise.
It's not easy to start a small business, and it takes a lot of skill, and so there is a strong public role in helping prepare people, giving them the critical thinking skills and the ability to analyze and seize opportunities through education and through the direct assistance that's provided through organizations like MACID. Public sector can also make it easier for people to start businesses within particular sectors by helping build a market for that sector. So that's one of the approaches that we take is, we're doing a lot to try to build, for example, the sector of energy efficiency and by creating demand for improving the efficiency of homes and buildings. And that creates a market for an entrepreneur who's a contractor.
Justin Prater is hoping there will be a lot of interest in the Startup Challenge from young people.
It's a way for us to try to spur entrepreneurship among the youth. You know, too many kids leave high school and college thinking that they have to find a job rather than create their own. So we hope to be able to assist anyone looking to work for themselves or turn their dreams into reality.
I think sometimes we overlook the entrepreneurship as an option for people who want to stay in the community that they're from. There's really a range of ways in which it seems to me that entrepreneurship is a viable and important option as a way for people to make their own choices about life.
Again, Jason Bailey of the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy. For WMMT, I'm Sylvia Ryerson in Whitesburg.
The deadline for folks to apply for the small business competition they mentioned is November 29th. The website where you can find more information about this contest and the other programs that help small businesses in Kentucky is kybizinfo.com. This fall, a West Virginia State Senate panel began looking at the SOAR program in Kentucky for inspiration as it explores ways to help jumpstart the economy in the coalfields of southern West Virginia. The initiative is called the Southern Coalfields Organizing and Revitalizing the Economy Initiative, or SCORE. I recently attended the second meeting in Oak Hill, West Virginia. The first speaker, John David, began the night by quoting Mother Jones, who said that there's never peace in West Virginia because there's never justice. David then told lawmakers he hopes they turn that around, first by addressing the lack of affordable housing.
How we can, in essence, save energy, how in essence then we can put some of the youth to work that we're training here into permanent jobs to improve housing.
David is the director of the Southern Appalachian Labor School, a community development and education-based nonprofit, according to its website. He passed out a packet that also included a plan to upgrade a building and create a community hub for veterans, making the transition to civilian life. Nothing was off the table, as each person that chose to speak had 2 minutes at the podium. Other areas of concern brought up by the community included an aging population, disaster preparedness, quality child care, and more. West Virginia Citizen Action Group Executive Director Gary Zuckett talked about water.
This is very essential for our tourism, for our business and economic development. Businesses don't want to locate in a place where the water is no good. And for healthy communities and families. We all know about the threats to our water from mining, chemical spills.
The Citizen Action Group's main goal, according to its website, is to give average citizens a voice when it comes to public policy. Zuckett also suggested funding the public service districts to complete water protection plans, resist attempts to weaken environmental law, and make sure the DEP is enforcing the laws. Suggestions from other speakers ranged from renewable energy tax credits to selling water as a natural resource. Some folks brought up investing in tourism marketing, something brought up by co-chair of the committee, Senator Art Kirkendall of Logan County, and Senator Bill Laird of Fayette County.
One of the things particularly significant in this senatorial district is the tourism, the natural beauty of the area, the Greenbrier Valley, certainly the New River Gorge. We enjoy a common watershed, a lot of recreational opportunities in this portion of the state of West Virginia.
A recent article in the Charleston Gazette points to a sharp decline in the rafting business over the past few years. And as lawmakers talk about investing more into the tourism industry, the state audit is questioning the ethics of the Hatfield and McCoy Authority, which oversees some of the ATV trails in the state. The state auditor said it was operating as if the laws didn't apply to it. The SCORE committee plans to meet two more times. While the last meeting will be held in Logan County, the next location has not been established yet.
You build your nest into trees, you gathered all the grass and twigs, but it is not made to last. In a circle you will fly, stretching out your beady eye, hunter, you are blind.
Whoa. Hey, was that a hummingbird? All right, it was just a recording, but real-life hummingbirds are braving the cold and snow in growing numbers in late autumn and early winter in our region, especially a rust-colored bird known as the rufous hummingbird. Back in November 1990, National Aviary ornithologist Bob Mulvihill caught the first rufous hummingbird that any researcher had documented in the state. Today, on the Allegheny Front's Bird Files, Mulvihill has more on the rufous hummingbird.
Just about every written account of the rufous hummingbird uses the word feisty. That's because this 3-inch-long, 3-gram bird is anything but pint-sized when it comes to defending its territory or driving off potential predators. With its aerial maneuverability and speed, the rufous hummingbird is a match for intruders hundreds of times its size. Jays, hawks, cats, and even humans are likely to buzz off when this mighty mite of a bird dive-bombs them. The rufous hummingbird shows its toughness in other ways, too. It has the longest migration of any hummingbird, routinely flying 2,500 miles between breeding and wintering grounds. It nests in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains, where it usually finds snow still covering the ground when it arrives. But this hardy hummingbird seeks out tiny flying insects that become active even on cold, sunny days. Historically, the range of the rufous hummingbird was confined to these northwestern areas in summer and to Mexico in the winter. But in the past few decades, the species has begun to expand its range eastward. Pioneering birds have plotted a new migratory route, which now regularly brings them all the way across the continent. When they show up here in the late fall, they often must endure cold temperatures and even snow, just like in the Rockies. After staying in our area for several weeks, most of the rufous hummingbirds continue migrating south to the Gulf Coast. Although the adult male rufous hummingbird bears unmistakable bright orange-brown plumage, females and immature birds closely resemble other species. That includes the more familiar ruby-throated hummingbird. But the ruby-throated hummingbirds that visited your feeders throughout the spring and summer have all left by early October. So, please consider leaving your hummingbird feeders up until after Thanksgiving, and let researchers know about your sightings so that they can learn even more about the biology of these cold weather hummingbirds.
The National Aviary's Bob Mulvihill encourages you to connect with him with your hummingbird sightings. His Twitter handle is @BobMulvihill. Bird calls for this segment come courtesy of the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, recorded by Jeffrey Keller, William Gunn, and Richard Nelson. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from NPR, WETS in Johnson City, and WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky. Music in today's show was provided by Andy Agnew Jr., the Black Twig Pickers, Stacy Grubb and Alan Johnston with Montcole, West Virginia, Annie Patterson, who sang The L&N Don't Stop Here Anymore, written by Gene Ritchie, and Andrea Tomasi with Falcon Song. Send us a tweet. We're at @InAppalachia, and I'm at WV Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia, with career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.